Hey, Bay Area, come on out to 111 Minute Thursday night for an evening of community, art, music, and culture. At 6 o'clock, we'll feature a rapturous performance of Lion Dancers from a world-renowned troupe out of San Francisco's Chinatown. Then at 8 o'clock, DJ One Way Possible will take the stage and get the house bouncing with an in-person live broadcast of his nightly set. It's all part of Downtown First Thursday on 2nd Street between Market and Howard in San Francisco. You can find more info at KALW.org.
This is KALW. San Francisco at 91.7 FM. State of the Bay is next.
Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm your guest host, Angie Cuero. Every Monday night, we are live and local with news, conversation, and culture from this place we call home. Tonight, we'll meet Stephen Sherrill, new supervisor of San Francisco's District 2. Then, we'll discuss how LGBTQ rights are coming under threat from Washington, and what local organizations are doing to protect their communities and fight back. Finally, we'll hear from a local runner who recently completed an incredible feat, completing 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days. First, we'll hear the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump's sweeping order that requires proof of citizenship to register to vote is facing its first legal challenge. NPR's Jude Joffe Block reports the federal lawsuit filed today argues the executive order is an unconstitutional overreach that threatens the voting rights of millions of Americans.
A coalition that promotes the voting rights of various groups, including Latino Americans, military families, and Arizona college students, brought the lawsuit. It argues that voting rules are up to the states and Congress, not the president. Trump's executive order seeks to overhaul voting in this country, including by requiring proof of citizenship, like a U.S. passport, to register. Plaintiffs say that will prevent many from registering to vote. In the lead-up to the 2024 election, Trump and his allies pushed the baseless narrative that non-citizens would vote in large numbers. In fact, past audits have shown such cases are very rare. Jude Joffe Block, NPR News.
President Trump says the U.S. government is still looking for missing journalist Austin Tice. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Trump says they continue to run into dead ends.
Austin Tice is an award-winning freelance journalist and Marine veteran. He wrote for The Washington Post, McClatchy Newspapers, and other U.S.-based outlets before he was captured in Syria in 2012. Speaking from the Oval Office, President Trump said there's been virtually no sign of him.
It's just a lot of dead ends. He's been gone for a long time. The problem is there's never been a sighting. You know, sometimes you'll have somebody, you're looking for him, and there's a sighting. There's never been a sighting of Austin.
In December, a rebel group ousted Syria's former dictator, leading to hopes that Tice would soon be found. Trump says they'll never stop looking until they find out something definitive. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
In France, far-right politician Marine Le Pen, who was a leading candidate to become president, has been barred from running for public office for 5 years after a French court today found her guilty of embezzling millions of dollars of EU funds. Le Pen was also sentenced to 4 years in prison with 2 years suspended. She says she will appeal. SpaceX is set to launch a privately funded human space flight from Florida's Kennedy Space Center tonight. From Central Florida Public Media, Brendan Byrne has more.
The mission will take the crew of 4 international participants to a polar orbit, a first for human spaceflight. After launching, the crew's Dragon capsule will head due south, putting them on an orbital path that will carry them over the poles of the planet. The crew will conduct 22 experiments from that orbit and will take the first X-ray from space. The mission is bankrolled by cryptocurrency entrepreneur Chun Wang, who was born in China but is a naturalized citizen of Malta.
Brendan Byrne reporting. You're listening to NPR News.
Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm your guest host, Angie Cuero. Later on in the show tonight, we'll be talking about how the recent actions by the Trump administration are impacting the LGBTQ community and what local organizations are doing to fight back. Then we'll speak to Chris Edel about his incredible accomplishment running 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days. First, we are so pleased to be joined by Supervisor Stephen Sherrill. He represents District 2 in San Francisco. That includes neighborhoods in the north part of the city, the Marina, Pacific Heights, Cal Hollow, the Presidio. He was appointed to the board by Mayor Breed in December. That was one of her last acts before leaving office. He's filling the seat vacated by Catherine Stefani after her election to the California Assembly. We're going to be finding out exactly what Supervisor Sherrill has been up to. What's really fascinating is that he switched party affiliations over the years, started out as a Republican, became an independent, and eventually a Democrat. We're going to find out what happened there. Likewise, District 2, as every district in San Francisco, has its own positives and its own challenges. We've been hearing that crime in San Francisco is down, especially the hated smash and grabs in Bay Area, or bipping, as they call it, in San Francisco. And that is down to an all-time low, as is a lot of crime throughout the Bay Area. We'll be asking him about that as well. So let's bring him on the air. Supervisor, welcome.
Hi there. How are you? It's great to be with you this evening.
I'm glad to have you. I'm helping the listeners to get to know you. This is your first political office, but you've been involved in public affairs for a good long time. In fact, you were director of the Mayor's Office of Innovation, and that put you right in the thick of homelessness issues. So tell me about your time with the Coordinated Street Response Team.
Well, Mayor Breed asked us to look at accountability and homelessness. And as we talked with many members of the system, the teams engaged in interfacing with people on the street, whether it's the encampment resolution team, homeless outreach teams, or the various street medicine teams, those teams were really struggling to share data. And so those teams came together and they really asked us for help. And they asked us to create a shared database so that they could have a comprehensive profile of one individual's interactions with all of city services. So for instance, if a homeless outreach worker met someone on the street, was trying to put them in a shelter, they would now know, hey, maybe that person has a substance use history, maybe they had an overdose recently. Instead of going into a shelter, maybe we should put them in a recovery bed instead. Those little details aren't going to solve every challenge, but it's a really important way to get these teams working together in a new way and show the importance of data analytics and integration over a large scale.
You know, homelessness has been one of the most intransigent issues for one mayor after another, one board after another. And I'm wondering if you feel like you moved the needle a little bit.
Well, I think we set the stage for a lot of what you're seeing right now. Mayor Lurie's recent reorganization of the street teams into neighborhood-based teams that are closely coordinating is very much based on the coordination that we did. And I think he's brought his own lens to it. And I'm very excited about the potential there. I don't think any one solution is going to solve all challenges.
Right.
I think that housing affordability is a crisis, fentanyl is a crisis, and all of these things combine. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't do every little thing we can.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was telling the audience while we were bringing you on the air that your party affiliation shifted over the years. You started as Republican, then you went to independent and went to Democrat. You know, I was wondering if you're one of those folks who says you didn't leave the Republicans left you, because we hear that a lot. Is that the case for you?
You know, I don't think that's really the case for me. I grew up in a Republican household, but in a household that always, always prioritized the freedom of choice, the freedom to love who you want to love, and really focused on science. And, you know, it was a small government, low tax household, but, you know, I had an opportunity to intern in the Bush White House, and that was incredibly interesting. But at the same time, it really showed me that my core beliefs were not reflected in the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. And, you know, shortly thereafter, I got to see President Obama elected, and the hope and the optimism of this country was something that I really shared. And, you know, and so I left the Republican Party, and my first job was working for an independent, Mike Bloomberg, right out of college, who was the independent mayor of New York City. And so that was a cool thing to be. Let's focus on governing, on government, on delivering services to residents. And so party became something that was a little less important to me, but my values stayed very, very true. In many ways, my political beliefs have changed very little over time, but it's really about embracing who you are and saying to the people around you, I love you, I respect you an enormous amount, but I need to go with where I am. And so, you know, over the last few years, I hadn't voted for a Democrat. I don't think I voted for a Republican since I voted for Mike Bloomberg when he was running as an independent on the Republican ballot ticket. And so, you know, it was just a very natural thing for me, but I'm not sure I ever really was a Republican when I look at my political beliefs. Mm-hmm. And I feel very comfortable in my values and my beliefs in prioritizing people's right to choose who they are and who they want to love and who they want to be. And at the end of the day, my body, my choice, I think is incredibly important. As my former boss, Mayor Breed, said, if it isn't your body, it isn't your choice.
Mm. So let's scoot over to your first time in political office. That's where you are now. You were appointed in December. So what priorities did you set right away, and how did you arrive at those?
Yeah, the number one priority that I set was constituent services. As an appointed supervisor, I didn't spend all the time going out there and campaigning and knocking on doors. And I want all of my constituents to know that I represent them, and I really do care. I think that nationally we've gotten away from some of the small, everyday quality of life issues. And one thing I really admire about my predecessor, Catherine Stephanie, is how she continued to focus on those every day in her work. And so constituent services, making sure that my constituents know that I will be responsive to them, I'll be their voice to the government and not the other way around, is my number one priority. Mm-hmm. And additionally, you know, my two other policy priorities that I'll talk about quickly, public safety is just critical to this city and always will be. And then I really believe that the lifeblood of this city is our small merchant corridors. So seeing small businesses succeed is something that is very near and dear to my heart and also to the recovery of San Francisco.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the recovery of San Francisco. There are the things that we do need to recover from, and then there's how we're painted out of Washington with language that I can't repeat about how dismal it is here and crime is so bad and there are all kinds of people in the street you don't want to encounter. You never really hear about the tunnel tops. You never really hear about the beauty of the place. And I'm wondering how you feel we're doing, especially with your interest in the Presidio. How are we doing at countering that narrative?
Well, I think the most important ways to counter that narrative are to create incredible experiences for the people who are here today and who are visiting. For, you know, when the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference is here, or, you know, we're going to have an opening of the Nintendo store coming up. All of these different things where there's regular tourists coming in. What can we do every day to make their experience absolutely fabulous? Ensuring that our streets are safe and clean, regardless of what statistics may be, is the number one most important thing we can do for people who live here, people who work here, and people who visit here. Our visitors are going to be the best PR agency we can possibly have.
You know, we were talking a little bit about safety on the streets. And knowing I was going to talk mm-hmm. to you, I was particularly interested in a Chronicle article that came out today. They did a Chronicle analysis of crime, and this is just a year after there was declared a war on bipping, which is, you know, breaking into the car and taking what you can. It looks as though not only have the number of reported car break-ins fallen precipitously, according to the article, the Chronicle analysis found that it hit a 22-year low in 2024. What do you make of that, and how might that be translated to other issues that we're facing in San Francisco?
Well, first of all, I think it's an incredibly important statistic to see in the context that last March, we passed Prop E, which allowed the police department to take advantage of new technologies like automated license plate readers, leveraging new technologies to help enhance the ability of our police force to keep us safe is so, so critical. The second thing I'd look at is that even though car break-ins are at a record low, we can't stop now. The second we let our focus slide is the second things slide back into the way things were. And so I want to be really, I'm so proud to be in a city with a police department that's worked so hard to get us where we are. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be supportive of their keeping going. But the other thing I want to note, I spoke to the restaurant association the other night, and they said the tourists that were missing most are not even tourists. They're visitors from Marin, from the East Bay, from the peninsula. And they, by and large, still have a perception of a lack of safety for their cars in San Francisco. Perception always is a delayed follower of reality. We need to keep the reality going. We need to push back against the perception. Articles like this are great because they show how much work we're doing here. And this is a safe city, and we got to keep it safe and make it safer every day.
I want to go back to the Trump edicts coming out of Washington. And, of course, he's talking about the Presidio, your district. How serious a threat is there to the Presidio? And from your position, how much does it fall on your plate to address that?
Well, I think my number one priority is the 3,000 plus people living in the Presidio. I mean, Swords to Plowshares is an incredible organization that houses over 150 disabled, formerly homeless veterans. There are some incredible organizations and incredible businesses in the Presidio. It is an absolute model of a public-private partnership. I mean, you know, you talk about a president who thinks he's a business person. I mean, look no further than the Presidio for a profitable enterprise. Mm-hmm. And that's probably one of the biggest reasons why, you know, there are a lot of things to fear from Washington right now. I think funding cuts to Medicaid and medical research are probably the ones that I'm most worried about, in addition to transportation and infrastructure funding. When it comes to the Presidio, that executive order, it targeted non-statutory spending, and all the spending is statutory. So I'm not too worried about that executive order, but I think we need to keep an eye on things, and I think we need to make sure that the residents of the Presidio feel safe. But at the end of the day, it's been really well managed, really well run. You mentioned Tunnel Tops. My kids love Tunnel Tops. I'm sure everybody else's do too. But, you know, I'm proud we have a city that is a great city attorney like David Chu, staying on top of these things, an incredible representative of Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi.
The clock has almost caught us, Supervisor, but I want to slip in our fun question we always ask. Can you recommend a favorite restaurant or spot in the city?
Oh, boy. well, I mean, I can recommend an enormous number. I'm headed to Perry's for a cheeseburger later for dinner tonight. So if you're around, come say hi. And then maybe if the night goes, you know, a little the wrong direction, we might end up at Brazen Head for a late drink. But
that would be the right direction.
Those are two great ones. Those are two great ones. You can't, I mean, this city, the Chronicle just came out with their 151 top 100 restaurants in the area. I'm looking forward to 1 through 50, to, you know, tomorrow when they come out with that too.
That is awesome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure being with you. Thank you.
Supervisor Sherrill of District 2. Coming up next, the impact of Donald Trump's executive orders and that of the shifting political climate on local LGBTQ individuals and organizations. What is at stake? How is resistance being organized? That's right after the break. Stay with us.
Hello, this is James Cass, Executive Director of KALW. We can all see it. Independent journalism is facing real threats, but we are standing strong. Beginning April 8th, we're inviting you to stand with us to support journalism that pushes back against misinformation and ensures that every voice is heard. We're committed to truth and storytelling that connects our communities, but we can't do it alone, so let's do this together. Invest in KALW, because the future starts now.
Next time you're browsing the web, click on over to KALW.org for the latest in local news and culture, updates from our music hosts, and unique features you can only hear from the talented crew at KALW Public Media. Visit KALW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm your guest host, Angie Coiro. In less than 3 months, Donald Trump's administration has rolled out a wave of executive orders that directly target the LGBTQ community, restricting transgender health care, dismantling DEI programs, slashing federal funding. These policies and the shifting political climate that underlies them aren't just headlines. They have immediate, real-world consequences already being felt here in the Bay Area. Local organizations, bless them, are not sitting down and taking it. Tonight, we'll talk to three guests. They're on the line now, helping us to break down the changes, look at how they're affecting the communities, and how they are getting ready to push back. Let's start with Suzanne Ford with us. Suzanne is the Executive Director of San Francisco Pride. Welcome to State of the Bay, Suzanne.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Jill Jacobs is with us too, Chief Executive Director of Family Builders. Family Builders works with young people in the child welfare system, including LGBTQ youth and their families. Jill, welcome aboard.
Good evening. Happy to be here.
And with us as well, Dr. Tyler Tamir, who serves as CEO of the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. So glad to have you with us, Dr. Tamir.
Thanks so much for having me.
Our phone lines are open. We want to hear from you as part of this segment. Have the executive orders been affecting you or someone you love, or are you afraid they will? What about the growing quote-unquote anti-woke climate? Has that affected your work or your community or you personally? We definitely want to hear your stories as we talk this over. You can email us now, stateofthebay@kalw.org. You can also call us to be on the air, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Dr. Tremere, let's start with you. What has it felt like for you and your colleagues to watch this onslaught of attacks?
Yeah, you know, it has been nothing short of overwhelming for our team and our community over the past, you know, just short of 70 days. It feels really overwhelming to think that it's only been 70 days, to say that out loud, if I'm honest. The pace of which things have been changing has been unrelenting. And as soon as the first few days after the inauguration, we began receiving notices and demands from the White House in the form of executive orders and in the form of demands through our funding portals as an organization that receives direct funds from the federal government. And those demands were in the form of notices that said things like, remove the mention of transgender people from your website. It said things like remove all mentions of diversity, equity, and inclusion from your website and from all of your materials on from the very existence of who you are. We view all of these things as an existential threat to the mission of who we are as an organization. And it struck fear into the very existence of who we were as an organization and made us really have to think about how we would proceed as an organization.
You are party to a lawsuit challenging some of these executive orders that are targeting the community. Give us a brief overview of which orders the lawsuit is going after.
Yes. So we've filed a lawsuit, San Francisco AIDS Foundation v. Trump. We are among several plaintiffs across the country, although there are three here in the Bay Area, San Francisco AIDS Foundation, San Francisco Community Health Center, and the GLBT Historical Society. Filed by Lambda Legal, the lawsuit challenges Trump's executive orders, one of which repudiates the very existence of transgender people and prohibits federal contractors and grantees from recognizing and respecting their identities or advocating for their civil rights. And then separately, the lawsuit also challenges two separate executive orders which terminate equity-related grants and prohibit federal contractors and grantees from employing diversity, equity, and inclusion and accessibility principles in their work. So essentially, these orders, we believe, prohibit organizations like San Francisco AIDS Foundation and many of our nonprofit partners around the country from really existing. If we can't employ the values of our organization and lift up diversity, equity, and inclusion, if we can't prioritize those that are hardest hit by the HIV epidemic through an equity lens, then we can't get to the end of the epidemic. If we can't work specifically with trans and non-binary people to ensure that their lives matter, that their lives are prioritized in our response to the HIV epidemic, and that their healthcare is prioritized in all the work that we do, then we can't accomplish our mission. And these orders strike at the very our very ability to do that. And so we're taking our fight to the court.
Do you have some insight? By the way, I want to acknowledge we do have callers. I'm going to ask you to hold on the line while I bring our first questions to all three of our guests, and then we'll go to the phone lines. That's 866-798-8255, and thank you with your patience for that. Let me ask you, Doctor, what hate is all of this tapping into? Is this universally, I don't want to say universally, is this erasure of trans people strongly supported? What are you seeing out there in the public?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that these, all of these things are not new. These are the same principles that have existed in playbooks for a very long time. You know, this is the playbook of white supremacy. This is the playbook of principles that have existed throughout time. What is different is the unrelenting pace by which this is happening, the money that is behind this attack on our people, and how prepared I think the power behind this attack is in this particular moment. We were not prepared for how quickly all of this would happen over the last few months, and are really trying to catch our breath at the pace at which we are, the pace at which all of this is happening.
Mm-hmm. Let me bring Suzanne in on this, executive director of San Francisco Pride. Suzanne, you talked to KTVU and you said that a number of sponsors have already pulled out of this year's Pride Parade. That includes Comcast, Anheuser-Busch, Diageo, a local wine brand, La Crema. Your organization is short $300,000, and that's to ballpark the figure. Tie that to what's going on in Washington.
Sure. I think that that hate that you're asking Dr. Tamir about, it can't help but affect corporations, businesses, and how they value investing in certain organizations. And I think that the fear also of raising your head up and supporting an organization whose very existence is about DEI, you know, I think that that might be a bridge too far sometimes for some corporations. You know, though that list that you shared, we'd had long time relationships with all of those people. It wasn't like we had just had a contract for a year. We had partnered with them for a long time. You know, I think that the federal government, the Trump administration has emboldened people that have, you know, they've had these ideas for a long, long time. They just feel emboldened and it's kind of out of the closet now. It's a reverse of the years of work that's been done in this community. And so now I think that you're seeing that some corporations are hedging their bet and they're protecting themselves. I will say that La Crema reached back out to us, and I can confirm that we are in talks with them to include La Crema in the celebration this year, and I fully expect that they will participate.
That is good news. That's good to hear. I'm curious about the language that you're hearing about the agencies or from the agencies that have pulled out. How are they painting this?
Yeah, I mean, they're being very, very diplomatic, I would say. They all, they will just simply, most of them were by email, informed us that they did not have the budget this year to sponsor San Francisco Pride. No one has come out, and I don't think anybody wants to say that they're bowing to pressure either from stockholders or from fear of the federal government. No one's really saying that, but I think we all know that is definitely affecting their decision.
Mm. Is there any upside to big corporate sponsors stepping out and leaving maybe more the small businesses, more locally involved groups? Is there any silver lining here?
I wouldn't say for that. I would say that silver lining is that we have found new partners like SFO. You know, and SFO is not a big tech company. It's somebody locally here that is, you know, the airport's important to our economy. So I think that is kind of a silver lining. I do think, you know, our individual donations went up. We raised $30,000 over the last 2.5-3 weeks. So I am encouraged that way. And then we've had some other local San Francisco corporations that have reached out to us and have we've initiated. We haven't signed everybody yet. And then I will say somebody returned, Levi's. And, you know, Levi's has a strong, deep ties to the LGBTQ community here in San Francisco. Levi's was one of the first corporations to offer benefits to same-sex partners. And so we want to acknowledge that they've come back and they had been gone for a few years. And so we want to recognize them stepping up and appreciate what they've done. As far as small businesses, you know, we are already like San Francisco Pride, the weekend of Pride, The small businesses in San Francisco are, you know, are linked to the success of SF Pride. I think the last economic study commissioned by the city was in 2015, and they found a $357 million impact on the San Francisco economy. Given, you know, the pandemic and inflation, I would wager that it's close to $1 billion now. So everybody in San Francisco has a stake in San Francisco Pride being successful.
Mm. Let me take these questions over to Jill Jacobs, Chief Executive Officer of Family Builders. Jill, Family Builders supports youth in the foster care system, and that, of course, includes those in the LGBTQ community. So talk about the work that you're doing.
Sure. We work with young people that are in the foster care and actually the juvenile justice systems. And we have a particular program where we work with the families, actually, of LGBT youth when the families are struggling with their kids' sexual orientation or gender identity. And it's actually a really wonderful program and very successful. And the youth that we're serving in those programs right now are terrified. They're absolutely terrified. Even though our California's Attorney General, Rob Bonta, has come out and said young people will have access to gender-affirming care. Kids are on the internet, so they know what's going on in Tennessee and Florida and Texas and all those other states that are even more repressive than California. And they're scared. They're scared. They've had the courage to finally come out and be who they are, and now somebody's coming in and putting this tight clamp down on them. The day after the election, the Trevor Project, which is a suicide prevention hotline for young people, had an increase of 700% in their calls.
Oh, Lord.
Just tells you how terrified young people are, and their families are too. So it's really challenging. And then, you know, the rollover part of that is the kids are terrified, the young people, and then it's our staff are just polarized about what do we do, or paralyzed, not polarized. Mm-hmm. And how do we support these young people? And then how do we support the staff that are doing this really challenging work to keep kids safe and keep their families paying attention to them and making sure that they're safe and that they know where to go for support. And if it's not their immediate caregiver, then who's your auntie? Who's your uncle? Who's your person that can be there for you? And making sure that we get that information to the young people.
You know, I'm thinking about how much problem adults are having right now. We're hearing constantly about the depression. A lot of therapists are hearing that, and this is from adults, you know, they're having trouble at work, they're having trouble getting off the couch, they're having trouble dealing with life, and it's all tied to this constant flow of bad news, the doom scrolling that goes with that. And I think there's an additional layer for young people, and you can check me on this, and that is that young people have their own venues of communication. And just as is true with adults, there can be miscommunication. It's bad enough, they could hear that it's even worse than it is. How accurate is the news that they're hearing, and what kind of channels do they have to check their reality on what they're hearing?
Don't know that they do check their reality. And I think the other big difference between young people and those 18 and over is, even though most of us in the LGBT community don't feel like we have a lot of power right now, young people have even less power. They have lots of people, whether it's school or home or healthcare or lots of other people that are running their lives for them. And they don't always have a say. They don't always get what they want when they have a say. So I think it's exacerbated for young people, and they don't have the outlets that we have. They don't necessarily know that there's a lawsuit that's been filed that might be helpful. And I don't know how well they fact check the information that they're getting. They're responding to what they're hearing.
That's Jill Jacobs, Chief Executive Officer of Family Builders. Suzanne Ford is with us, Executive Director of San Francisco Pride, and Dr. Tyler Tamir, CEO of the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. You're listening to State of the Bay. We're going to have a few more moments here with our guests, and we want to bring you on the air via email or on our phone line. The phone line, it's open right now, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Talk. And we have email coming in from Mars. The Trump administration, Mars says, is dropping the T from their websites when LGBTQ is referenced. Now, for example, at the National Park Service website commemorating Stonewall, it only says LGB in referencing the community. It's a deliberate, bigoted attempt to erase the very existence of trans people. Dr. Tremere, that goes right to what you're saying in that, in what you were saying, which is these people are not allowed to even exist anymore. They are ceasing to exist as human beings.
Yeah, I mean, I think a very tangible example right alongside that is we saw a very similar attack to the National AIDS Memorial Grove on their national park listing, as well as the National AIDS quilt, memorial quilt that's located here in the Bay Area. And then even us here at San Francisco AIDS Foundation, we've been running a nationally recognized MPOX campaign. As you may remember, over the last several years, we had an MPOX outbreak here in the region. We have been running, as San Francisco AIDS Foundation, a public health campaign over the last couple of years to encourage people to get the second dose of their vaccination. We created a campaign that centered Black and Brown transgender individuals. This campaign was lifted up by the CDC Foundation as an award-winning campaign. In fact, they reached out and asked if they could replicate this campaign in cities across America. We received multiple rounds of new funding prior to January of 2025 to replicate this campaign. And then a week after the inauguration, the grant was terminated because it featured trans, Black and Brown individuals. You know, we have also recently lost an NIH-funded grant because it featured, it centered lot of research that centered the lives of trans people. I mean, there are grants being terminated around the country very specifically because they name transgender individuals. So, you know, we are in a time where trans lives, non-binary lives, gender expansive lives are under attack every single day. This is not a time for people to be silent. This is a time for everyone to stand up and make noise because this community is being erased. They are trying to erase this group of people, and we have to stand up and fight alongside them.
I want to give a little more background on that, and this was published by The Guardian today. In 2012, the FDA approved pre-exposure prophylaxis, PREP, PrEP, an antiviral drug taken once a day, highly successful at preventing new HIV infections. That was in 2012, and now many of the terminated HIV studies we're talking about now were focused on improving access to drugs like PrEP in communities that have high rates of infections, including trans women and Black men. So you have it right there, that these are very targeted, very specifically targeted. Suzanne, this year's theme for Pride, SF Pride, is joy in resistance, queer joy in resistance. Talk about how important that message is right now.
Well, you know, it's queer joy is resistance. And I think we have to do two things this year at San Francisco Pride. Number one, we have to stand up to what we've been talking about here. The oppressive regime in Washington, D.C., and they're targeting the trans community, the LGBTQ community. So the first thing is we have a resistance contingent that's board led. It came into existence in 2017. So at the front of the Pride Parade, there will be a resistance movement, and you will see an opposition to what's coming out of Washington, D.C. However, at the same time, we want to remember, you know, our community finds joy in supporting each other and being inclusive, and we don't want to lose that. I think the other side right now is finding a lot of joy in taking rights away from us. And so we want to make sure on Pride Sunday that you can come and voice your displeasure with what we're facing, but you can also come to San Francisco Pride this year. We're going to create a safe container, and we want you to come and be with your community and be safe. And we want you to enjoy each other. And we want to let the world know that, no, you cannot take away our joy. In fact, queer people have been joyful in the midst of oppression throughout the history of this country. And we're going to continue to do that.
Yeah, the resilience is part of the character of the community. And, you know, one of the things I notice in all of the protests that are going on now, and you can tell me if this is building for you at SF Pride, I've noticed that, for example, with the Tesla takedowns, even though there's no instant immediate feedback or instant immediate win, it's just that joy, and it's just the support of the people who get out there and protest together. You see smiles on people's faces when they're out there. We're going to see smiles at the SF Pride Parade.
Oh, I promise. We are. And, you know, I am in community with Tyler, and we see each other. And when Tyler and I see each other in a crowd, our face lights up, and we know that we're safe, that we're there for each other. We know all the queer nonprofit leaders here in San Francisco. We are a tight-knit bunch. And so I will say one of the things that is like the silver lining you were looking for earlier is that joy in being with each other. And this crisis is giving us the cause and the time to be with each other more, I think. And I think that's what's going to grow out of this. And that's what's going to get us through, is that joy of being with each other and knowing you can just, I'll be in a crowded room and I can look around. There are people that have led this resistance in this city since the 1970s. And you can just see the joy in being in the room with people that you know have done the work in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Jill, let's talk about your funding. Has it been put at risk by the cuts?
Depends on what you call risk. We've experienced some loss of sponsorship. We have our annual fundraising event coming up the end of April, and we've had some just local businesses. We don't get sponsorship from really major corporations. We're not very big, but a number of small businesses have just declined to fund us this year. We are largely government funded. We do not at the moment have any direct federal funding, so we can't just, you know, take it away. But we are largely funded through child welfare systems, and a third of that funding is federal funding. So it hopefully will end up in the courts. It depends on, you know, the power that executive orders have over state laws and those kinds of things. And I know that's all being hashed out in a number of different arenas. So at the moment, no. But am I sleeping well at night? No, not at all.
No, of course not. And, you know, it's a time for heroes to show up. We're seeing this in the legal profession, where some legal firms are capitulating to Donald Trump and team, and others are standing up saying, this is a time for law and order. This is a time for us to protect our integrity. And I suspect the people who may stand up for you, if you have to tap into more private funding, they're going to turn out to be the heroes. And I'm wondering if you're starting to lay the groundwork to solicit more private funding.
Well, we certainly are, and we'll all be in competition with each other around that, as we often are. And it really is a time for us to stand up. I'm seeing a lot of colleague organizations, not in the LGBT community, but in the child welfare space, take what I would call a protectionist stance, which I completely understand. I understand their survival. So they're scrubbing their websites. They're removing a lot of language in a way that they can. Some of us can't do that and don't want to do that. It is the core of our existence. It is who we are. And so we have to stand up. And sometimes, certainly in the child welfare arena, I'm the lone voice. Very, very often I'm the lone voice. But we have to speak up. We have to be there. We have to do this. You know, in the foster care system, we don't know which kids are going to be LGBT today, tomorrow, or next week. And we need to assume that any and all of our children are. And therefore, we have to stand up and make sure that they are all safe, that they're advocated for, that they have access to the support and the services and the care that they need.
We have email from Jacob, who says, I'm a supporter of this panel and of the Pride Parade. However, I'm wondering what adjustments this panel feels they can or should make, given that the current approach has been counterproductive at the moment. And I don't know specifically what Jacob means about counterproductive, but I'm looking, Dr. Tamir, at what we've seen, for example, from Gavin Newsom, who's, you know, working to expand his public national presence. And as one way of doing that, through the trans people under the bus. So I'm wondering how the organizations that are trying to stand up for HIV research, who's standing up for Pride, who are standing up for the young kids, is there an overall review of how it's being approached in the public front? Is there any fresh look at technique or tactics that's being discussed? Dr. Tamir?
Yeah. You know, I think now more than ever is the time for organizations around the country, especially LGBT organizations, to remain grounded in their values. It is not time for us to compromise the vision and the values by which our organizations were founded. You know, San Francisco AIDS Foundation, as we were making our decision about our lawsuit, had a very long and thoughtful conversation about what the road ahead looked like for us. And through the darkest of days, we recognized that our values as an organization were our guiding light. Our values of justice, of dignity, of courage, leadership, and excellence. And we knew that we needed to remain courageous no matter what that meant for us in the road ahead, and that we had to stand up as leaders in this moment, no matter how difficult the road ahead was, and no matter what folks threw at us, because the community needed us to be leaders for them. Mm-hmm. They needed us to stand up for them no matter what, because often the most vulnerable don't have the ability to stand up for themselves in the hardest of times.
And that's where we're going to leave it. You have to savor everything that goes right these days, and this panel has really done it. Suzanne Ford, Jill Jacobs, and Dr. Tyler Tremere, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Jill Jacobs is CEO of Family Builders, a Bay Area-based organization that works with young people in the child welfare system. Suzanne Ford is executive director of San Francisco Pride. And Dr. Tyler Tremere is CEO of the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. We are going to move on over after the break to hear Ethan Elkind's interview with Chris Edel, who recently completed an incredible athletic feat. You will not want to miss hearing this. We're going to come right back here on State of the Bay.
This is Ethan Elkind. On the next Your Calls One Planet series, we'll discuss Sequoias of the Sea, a documentary that highlights the challenges facing California's kelp ecosystems and the efforts to restore this vital habitat devastated by a warming climate. We'll also discuss a ProPublica investigation revealing the National Institute of Health's plans to end funding for research on the health effects of climate change. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Angie Coiro and you.
And that is a rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call, and that takes place this evening at 7 here on KALW.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your fellow music traveler. Join me weeknights from 8 to 10 p.m. as we cross genres, generations, and go all across the musical map, discovering forgotten favorites, future favorites, and all the journeys in between. That's Monday through Friday nights, 8 to 10 p.m. right here on 91.7 KALW and KALW.org. Join us for the ride.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind, and tonight I'm thrilled to be joined by 45-year-old San Francisco resident Chris Edel. For most of us, running even one marathon seems like a daunting challenge. So imagine how he must have felt after completing the World Marathon Challenge, a grueling event in which he ran 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents. Well, rather than leave it to your imagination, we've invited him here tonight to talk to us all about it. Chris Edel, welcome to State of the Bay, and congratulations on what is truly a remarkable achievement. Chris Edel, welcome to State of the Bay, and congratulations on what is truly a remarkable achievement.
Thanks so much, Ethan.
So, Chris, just thinking about running 7 marathons in 7 days makes me feel, well, I would say exhausted, but it's really beyond exhausted. What made you decide to take on such an ambitious challenge?
It's a great question. It was triggered post-COVID. I was hitting close to 45 years old, and I had all these desires to do big physical races. And I realized time is ticking where a lot of these races may not be available to me over the next 10 years or so. And with the world starting to open up again, let's go on these adventures and really maximize the time that's available.
And what sort of training did you have to do? Did you have any experience in running anything close to that level of distance?
Nothing close to this level. I really only did about 1 to 2 marathons a year. So this was quite a big ramp up from my typical training.
And what was that training? Did you keep track of your steps? What was the process?
It was initially daunting to think about it from a 183-mile total distance perspective, but when I broke it down, I realized it's really just doing a marathon each day over the course of 7 days. So how do you reverse engineer a process to build the body resilience to handle back-to-back marathons? So over the course of a year of training, it was training for a marathon, but also training for the recovery process. How do I get my body feeling good enough to do a marathon the next day?
And how did you balance the training part with everything else in your life?
That was arguably the most difficult part. I have two kids, a two-year-old and a six-year-old. And as most people know that have kids, there's always blowups to your schedule from unexpected events, kids getting sick and getting pulled home from daycare, and then also juggling the work demands on top of that. So it required a very supportive wife, which I had, and really just being very diligent in terms of time management.
I can only imagine the support network you would have needed to juggle all of that. And then what about injuries? Was that a factor as you were training or during the marathons themselves?
Yeah, injuries were an interesting part of the journey. So I actually did quite well for about 11 of the 12 months. But on the 11th hour of my training, I sprained my ankle on the Great Highway, just unexpectedly stepping onto an uneven piece of pavement. And I actually thought that I broke my foot and had to go into urgent care. And I was really nervous because that was potentially 11 months down the drain of training. And the race was a big investment, not just from a time investment, but a financial investment as well. But fortunately, the physician that checked me out said, it's just inflamed and you're actually okay.
Well, I'm glad the Great Highway did not claim you as a victim for what otherwise an unbelievable feat. So let's talk about the races themselves. So you raced on all seven continents in 7 days. Can you talk about the locations and what that process was like?
Sure. The first marathon was in Antarctica, and the second marathon was in Cape Town, South Africa. The third one was in Perth, Australia. The fourth one was in Dubai. The fifth one was in Madrid, Spain. The sixth one was in Fortaleza, Brazil. And then the final one was in Miami, Florida. And we had a jet that contained all 50 to 60 racers and then also support staff, medic crew. So about 70 plus people on this plane.
It's a charter flight, essentially, that's designed to get you where you need to go with the limited amount of hours you have, right?
Yes, because there were so many unknown variables, like when the start times of the race would be, and a lot of it was dictated by the weather in Antarctica, which would dictate when all the other races would take place.
A lot of those locations seem pretty imaginable to me, but the one that really stands out is Antarctica. I just picture a big, vast ice sheet. Where do you run in Antarctica? What was that like?
Yeah, well, your description of it is pretty accurate. So we ended up going onto this ice field called Novo Station, which was about 100 miles inland, and it was an absolute vast ice wasteland. Nothing there, just completely flat, pure white. But at the same time, this incredible feeling of just really feeling like you're stepping onto the moon or like a different planet.
And do you need special shoes? I mean, if you're on ice, it seems like not the greatest surface to run on.
Yeah, that was definitely a challenge. Fortunately, they had sort of like a snowplow that would help mow over the ice to create some traction. But ice was definitely a risk. We actually had one runner who broke their wrist on the first marathon because they slipped on some blue ice when they were running.
Oh, man. All right. So hazardous as well as interesting. So all the different seven marathons that you ran, any moments stand out as particularly challenging or rewarding?
Yeah, the first one was stepping off the plane into Antarctica because we took this Russian-Soviet jet that was meant for cargo rather than for people. There were no windows, so we had no sense of understanding what we were landing into. So when those doors opened and we saw that vast emptiness in Antarctica, that was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. The second thing I remember was a marathon in Brazil. It was our sixth marathon, and the weather down there was just so hot, so humid, so tropical. And coming from San Francisco and running in the outer sunset where the weather is very different, that was pretty extreme, but also a very unique experience overall.
And were there challenging times where you thought, maybe I can't do this?
Overall, it felt pretty good. The Brazil portion was the only point where I had an inkling of doubt. And what actually happened was on the first 3 or 4 miles, there was a loop, but it was in a very crowded part of the boardwalk area in Fortaleza. And I overshot the loop and continued to run like a mile off course. And I remember finding myself in this very sketchy part of Brazil and thinking, man, I'm lost here. It's 90 degrees. I'm so tired. I'm so sleep deprived. Why am I doing this? But fortunately, I retraced my steps and got back on course and saw a few of the other runners, which quickly remotivated me to get on board.
Wow. Well, speaking of other runners, can you talk about the others who were on the same journey with you? I imagine it must have been quite a bonding experience.
It was an incredible bonding experience and very unexpected, because I think almost every racer came into it laser focused on seeing if they could complete the race. But it's that communal aspect of common suffering where we were all going through this unique experience together, that relationships started to form very quickly. And people came from such amazing backgrounds, completely different parts of the world, completely different socioeconomic groups, cultural groups, a lot of people running for a cause, a lot of people running for self-discovery, a few people running because they were famous runners in their own respective countries and they had a huge social media following. So it was just such a fascinating group of people, and there was a lot of inspiring aspects from that, really made the experience worthwhile.
And Chris, what was it like when you finished?
The most memorable part was not crossing the finish line, but it was the final mile or two before the finish line. I was in such physical pain, but there was this sense that at this point of the game, there's no way that I'm not going to finish this thing. And it created this sense of peace where I was running and it was the middle of the night and I was by myself. There wasn't anyone around me. And I almost had an outer body surreal experience, thinking like, this is almost like a dream. And this experience is going to end very soon. And it was just such a unique life experience.
Wow. And has the experience changed you? Do you feel like you've drawn some lessons, or it's changed how you think about the world now?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of runners get into running because they want to get in shape or they want to lose weight. But once you start getting addicted to running marathons, I think it becomes more of a psychological game than a physical one. You're always trying to see if you can push yourself beyond your capabilities. And that feeling of overcoming that inner critic or overcoming that inner voice in your head actually becomes an addictive element of itself. So for me, I took away that the human body is capable of so much more than you initially think it can be capable of.
So along those lines, any advice for anyone else considering a race like this?
Really just recognizing that you can achieve some pretty big things if you put your mind to it and think tactically, how do I develop a realistic plan to get there.
And closer to home, what's your favorite place to run here in the Bay Area?
I love running in the Presidio. I think the Presidio is just absolutely gorgeous, especially when you go underneath the Golden Gate Bridge and close to Crissy Field. But even continuing down, running through Fisherman's Wharf and going all the way down to the Ferry Building, he hits so many different elements of San Francisco, sees so many different types of people. You need to take a break. There's little shops that you can walk into, grab a muffin or a coffee or something. For me, the past year, just running so much in San Francisco, it made me fall back in love again with the city.
Well, wonderful to think that the Bay Area helped propel you to this amazing accomplishment. But congrats again on pulling it off. 7 marathons, 7 days, 7 continents. Chris Edel, thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay and telling us all about it.
Thank you so much, Ethan.
I'm grateful the show is over because I'm exhausted just listening to that. I hope you're not. Thank you for tuning in for State of the Bay this week. We're here with you every Monday, live and local. Thanks again to our guests this hour. At the top of the show, we talked to San Francisco District 2 Supervisor Stephen Sherrill. Thanks to him. And then the impact of the anti-LGBTQ edicts coming out of Washington. We spoke with Suzanne Ford, Executive Director of San Francisco Pride, Jill Jacobs, CEO of Family Builders, Dr. Tyler Tremier, CEO of the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. Thanks to them for joining us as well. If you missed any part of this conversation, fear not. The whole thing is going up online shortly at kalw.org/stateofthebay. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, you can visit that same page, kalw.org/stateofthebay. We hope you will join us, she's trying to say, next Monday at 6 o'clock. We'll sit down with San Francisco Unified School District Superintendent Maria Sue. Remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen and never miss an episode. If you have any questions or comments about us, please give us a line, stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. It was engineered by David Kwan. And D Minor, was our board operator. A replay of this morning's Your Call is next. My apologies, it's back-to-back Coiro because I sat in for Rose Aguilar this morning, but I promise to make it worth your time. I'm Angie Coiro. Good night, and thank you for listening to State of the Bay.